Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Australasian science from July, August 2019. So it's the most recent publication. I'm really should be reading more into the problem of induction. There's an area of probability theory which is hurting my head to read through it, so I'm just taking a break doing some other stuff on the way here. And so this is a magazine. It has various features. I won't read through the different features. Some really interesting articles. It's actually, in my opinion, better, written more clearly and easier to read than New Scientist. I find that I can now scan read the way I used to read articles years ago. So it's called Up Front, which is probably the forward. The guy Nolsch is the editor and publisher of Australasian editor and publisher. Oh, I have to see what that means. Australia's place in a modern space race. Australia's space industry will have to pick sides in a new space race 50 years since astronauts first landed on the moon. This month marks the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11's moon landing on the 20th of July 1969. I remember that. I think I was a little six person in kindergarten. We all ushered in. It was actually during daytime, in Australia. While our space exploration aspiration has since expanded to crewed missions to Mars, a new race to the moon has been gathering pace. Early this year, China landed a spacecraft on the dark side of the moon, where it launched a robotic rover, set up a colony of silkworms, and began growing potatoes and cotton, all with the intention of establishing a permanent Chinese colony by 2030. My only problem here is the ethics of putting silkworms in space. Okay, well, any animal, I suppose. India is planning to send an orbiter, lander, and rover to the moon's south pole this year as a trial for sending people to the moon within 3 years, and Russia plans to establish a moon colony in 2040. The new interest in returning to the moon stems from the potential to extract its minerals, which would enable it to be used as a staging post for exploration deeper into space. Okay, so the minerals are no use in mind for the moon sent back here. They're only if we want to use them further forward. For instance, it will be much cheaper to extract water from the moon than transport it from Earth, which costs approximately $1 million per kilogram. Oh my God! Oh! Gee whiz! Oh, I suppose you recycle it, but you know, your milk drink costs a fair amount. This could only be used for drinking water could not only be used for drinking water and to grow food, but to split into breathable oxygen as well as hydrogen for rocket fuel. I think there's probably more sources of oxygen on the moon than just water. There's also a prospect of mining rare and valuable minerals and returning them to Earth. For instance, helium-3 in moon dust has been touted as a key to safe nuclear energy, and a viable prospect valued at $3 billion a ton. Wow. So helium-3 comes from the solar wind collecting up there. So it's basically a solar wind collector. In March, the USA rejoined the moon race with Vice President Mike Pence declaring that they will send astronauts to the moon by 2040 to establish a permanent presence from 2028. With NASA's budget focused on scientific programs, the U.S. is likely to encourage partnership with the burgeoning private space industry led by technology billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. At a meeting of the newly revived National Space Council last year, U.S. President Donald Trump appealed to their vanity. "I've always said that rich guys seem like rockets. If you beat us to Mars, we'll be very happy. And you'll be forever even more famous." Oh, God. Oh, God. Musk's SpaceX and Bezos' Blue Origin are already reaching for the stars, but there will be also opportunities for Australia's space industry to partner with NASA and other space programs. While our industry is valued at $3.9 billion, the Australian Space Agency established just 12 months ago and to grow to $12 billion over the next 10 years. Just to give you sort of a view, I think the Australian bee industry, honey production is worth $12 billion. Yeah, it's sort of like, it's really bespoke. You know, sort of like, not kitchens, but, you know, it's not a kitchen, but sort of the plumbing industry. It's sort of down at that area. However, our fledgling space industry must straddle the divisive national interests in an era of trade wars and technology backlist between nations with the largest space programs. For instance, the Australian and US governments have cited national security concerns when banning Chinese telecommunication giant Huawei from the rollout of 5G telecommunication networks. And the US has also prevented technological giants like Google, Apple, and Intel from supplying Huawei. Space will hardly be immune from the growing hostilities. Quote, "It's now an operational warfighting domain in its own right," warned Malcolm Davis of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Australian Scientists last September. While Australian startup companies are shooting for the moon 50 years since the tracking station at Honeysuckle Creek played a vital role in the Apollo program, the headwinds in the national security look like grounding any launch to the dark side of the moon. Understand that last sentence. Okay. Browse, which is sort of like compiled by Guy Notch. So this is a really interesting chap, person, Guy Notch. To see if I can see if there's more about him. Any use? I'll probably have to look him up. Drinking alcohol at conception may damage the placenta. Okay. Well, conception, I think there's a so many day window where I think it's after there's the build up, and there's a strict 14 days of where the egg travels down the placenta, down to the uterus, and hatches to form the placenta. So conception and drinking alcohol are several days apart. Alcohol consumption during pregnancy, okay, is not at conception. Has been linked to poor growth of the placenta, causing conditions such as fetal growth restriction and low birth weight. Although most women cease drinking once they know they're pregnant, the effect of alcohol during the initial stages of pregnancy, even as early as around the time of conception, is less well understood. Now, Dr. Jacinta Kelly-Smith and Professor Karen Moritz of the University of Queensland have shown that growth of placenta of rats that consume alcohol around the time of conception was reduced significantly, providing new evidence of how pregnancy-related conditions develop. The research has been published in Development. Quote, "Using a rat model, we assess the ability of the embryo to implant into the uterus and, later, how well the blood vessels formed in the placenta. So we don't know how much alcohol these rats consumed and whether rats normally would consume alcohol." Ellis Smith explained, "The scientists found that even exposure to alcohol 4 days before or after fertilization, the growth function of the placenta, if it restricts the growth, quote, we found, well, clearly, so that they're obviously, I mean, I think humans have evolved the way that we get drunk and we process it, you know, have a hangover. Let's see what it says. We found early alcohol exposure reduced blood vessel formation in the placenta, and this risks led to fewer nutrients being delivered to the embryo," said Kalish Smith said. "Strikingly, the placentas of female embryos were particularly susceptible, with up to 70% reduction in size and a 32% drop in formation, limiting the ability of the placenta to transfer nutrients. My problem here is, in this, they haven't done a compare. Is that absolute or compared to males? This has implications for human health by helping to explain, in part, why babies exposed to alcohol in the womb are often born small." Kalish Smith said, "It's important to understand the causes of low birth weight because it's been shown to be an independent risk factor for diseases later in adulthood, such as type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and obesity. The observations provide an important basis for future research in pregnancy associated with conditions like fetal growth restriction." Quote, The next part of this project is to see whether nutrient supplementation can reduce or even prevent the adverse effects of alcohol exposure, Kelly Smith said. My point there is that if you drink alcohol, you may be doing other things. You might be less likely to breastfeed. Okay, exposure begins in the womb. Australian researchers have laid the rest of the long-standing question of whether the womb is sterile. They carefully collected the amniotic fluid of samples of 50 healthy women undergoing planned cesarean deliveries and found that nearly all contained bacterial DNA. Furthermore, all the newborns had bacteria in their meconium. All the 50 had meconium, which is the brown sort of like grease coming out of their bum. Quote, over the last decade, numerous studies have detected bacterial DNA in amniotic fluid and first past meconium, challenging the long-held assumption that the womb is sterile, said Lisa Stinn of the University of Western Australia, who's the lead author of the study published in Frontiers in Microbiologies. Quote, however, some argue that the results are false positive contaminants in the reagents used in DNA analysis. Well, I don't know. You should be able to sample something completely sterile and then see if you get the same thing. So, use the reagents completely sterile. To settle the issue, Stenson's group took strict measures to eliminate bacterial contamination when analysing amniotic fluid and meconium samples. For example, they purified the reagents used to amplify the traces of DNA in the samples, adding enzymes that digest DNA that might have contaminated them when they were manufactured. Quote, that does make sense. Despite these measures, we still found bacterial DNA in almost all the samples, Stilton said. Interestingly, the meconium microbiome varied hugely between individual newborns. The amniotic fluid biome, for the most part, contained typical skin bacteria such as Papilionibacterium acnes or Staphylococcus species. Researchers says it's important to determine whether the healthy womb harbours bacteria because this fetal microbiome is likely to have significant impact on the developing immune system, gut and brain. Quote, we found the levels of important immune modulators in the meconium and inflammatory mediators in amniotic fluid varied according to the amount of species of DNA presence. Now that is interesting. Stilton said. This suggests fetal microbiome has the potential to influence the developing fetal immune system. That's interesting. Well, you don't know whether the mother's producing it or the baby, I suppose. There is one small caveat. The DNA in these samples could have come from bacteria that were already dead in the womb. We have proven bacteria DNA in the present womb, but the next step will be to show whether these are alive and constitute a true microbiome, Stilton said. You would think that you'd be able to then culture it. Yeah, which would be, if it would not form a culture, that would be serious. Plastic pollution harms the bacteria that helps us breathe. 10% of the oxygen we breathe comes from just one kind of bacteria in the ocean. Lab tests have now shown that these bacteria are susceptible to plastic pollution, according to a study published in Communication Biology. Quote, we found that exposure to chemicals leaching from plastic pollution interfered with the growth, photosynthesis and oxygen production of Prochlorococcus. I think that's the most common one, isn't it? Oh, the ocean's most abundant photosynthetic bacteria. Yeah, the main thing is that most of our oxygen doesn't come from plants. That's my bacteria. This is the lead author, Dr. Sasha Chu of Macquarie University. Quote, now we'd like to explore the plastic pollution is having the same impact on these microbes in the ocean. Plastic pollution causes more than $13 billion in economic damage to the marine ecosystem each year. It sounds a lot of money, but it's really nothing. And the problem is only getting worse. Marine plastic pollution is expected to outweigh fish by 2050. That's amazing. So all your killer whales and everything, all the fish in the ocean, if you could all put them together, the plastic pollution is bigger. Quote, this pollution can leach a variety of chemical additives to marine environment, but unlike the threats posed by animals ingesting or getting entangled in plastic debris, the threat these leaches pose to marine life has received relatively little attention, says co-author Lisa Lisa Moore, Dr. Lisa Moore. What I would have to say is that plastics, you know that when you're doing plastics, you get your plastic that you put in, you pay a lot, or you can get a slightly cheaper plastic with stabilisers put in at flame retardant. So if, say, if you're getting, say, a piece of plastic for, say, a telecom communication, it's got to have flame retardants, lifetime, and you get up all these what's called plasticizers. So there's a lot of extra chemicals. So the plastic is just really a container for lots of chemicals. But you know this when you go into production. Okay, quote, we looked at a group of tiny green bacteria called Prochlorococcus. I think there's a variety in that species, which is the most abundant organism on Earth, with a global population around 3 octillion. Approximately 10 to 27. I'm just wondering what an octillion is. A thousand. I'm trying to work out what it is. Individuals, Terry says. These tiny microorganisms are critical for marine food web, contributing carbon cycling, and are thought to be responsible for up to 10% of the global oxygen production. Moore adds. So, one is very... In every 10 breaths of oxygen you breathe is thanks to these little guys, yet almost nothing is known about how the marine bacteria such as Prochlorococcus respond to human pollutants. You would think that such a huge population that have genetic diversity to do it. I see they're talking about two strains. The team exposed two strains of Prochlorococcus and found at different depths of the ocean. See, the difference is... We call them different species. I think they are effectively different species, different depths. In the ocean, chemicals leach from grey plastic grocery bags made from high-density polyurethane PVC matting. They found that exposure to these chemicals impaired the growth function of these microbes, including the amount of oxygen they produce, as well as altering the expression of a large number of their genes. Well, that's pretty normal. Like the expression of I express genes, if I drink food, my genes express different and produce more insulin and stuff like that. But what I was going to say is that we don't know the concentration. Our data shows that pollution may have widespread ecosystem impacts beyond the known effects on macroorganisms such as seabirds and turtles, like the McChokey. Tattoo says, quote, if we truly want to understand the full impact of plastic and pollution in the marine environment and find ways to mitigate it, we need to consider the impact of key microbial groups, including photosynthetic microbes. I would suppose that sounds like the end of a grant application. Giant trilobites discovered. So trilobites are these little sort of sea horseshoe crabs. I think they were... They're typically the Precambrian. We'll find out. And so they're before 550 to 500 million years ago is the sort of sea life, then the Octavian explosion, then 50 million years, they're out of the ocean on land. It's pretty amazing. Okay, giant trilobites with antennas and walking legs have been found preserved in 513 million year old rocks and Kangaroo Islands off the coast of South Australia. If you look at a map of Australia and look in the middle of the bite, you'll see a little sort of like a little sort of a large, in South Australia, a large triangle and a little peninsula. And at the end of that peninsula will be Kangaroo Island. I don't know. Trilobites are extinct in a group of marine creatures related to modern crustaceans and insects. So they had, forgotten it. The name of that, there's a chemical, they have this, like I can remember the chemical, it's a chain of, it's like cellulose but with an amino acid, or amino sal acid, it's called, it's gone from my head. They're pretty, so this is the mushrooms of it, mushrooms have it. It's gone from my head, can't remember it. Up to a 30 centimetre length, which is pretty big, because you know, normally if you see trilobites in your fossil shop, they're the size of a, maximum, that'd fit inside a glass, that type of stuff. 30 centimetres length is a workout. up to 37 weeks. Relicia Rex. Let's see, the author here is named after himself. Nope. Okay, I don't know what Relicia Rex means. The largest found in Australia of this age, the bigger than the dinner plate, the species is one of the largest animals living in the underocean at that time, said Professor John Patterson of the University of New England. Relicia rex would have certainly been a terror of the trilobites and most other seafood creatures for that matter, Patterson said. The discovery of exquisitely preserved specimens, including walking legs and with spines and crushing shells, shows that from sort of like you can imagine jousting. Oh gosh, I've got to really remember the cellulose starch. Oh, or cellulose. It's like cellulose, but not quite. Well, killers. The discovery, published in the Journal of Systematic Paleontology, is the latest of a sequence of important discoveries in Kangaroo Island. So shale is basically a clay, but with a high metal content, and so the metal content goes to the surface of the shale and forms sheer layers. It's sort of a semi-metamorphic rock. Okay. Which preserves important evidence of the first evolutionary arm race between ancient creatures and primates. I wonder if they had eyes. The main thing is the eye, and once the arm race predators the prey, really gets things going and seeing things go. So my science head teacher hated cockroaches, and with great aplomb killed them. You know, that just a lot of terror and screaming killed them all. And I, of course, said you're only making them stronger. By predating them, you make them stronger. Okay, quote, this new trilobite demonstrates that predatory giants and their sophisticated weaponry appeared during the earliest phase of animal evolution, said Patterson. Recent work at UNE found that novel and efficient forms of predation more than 50 million years ago fueled the evolutionary big bang of adaptations of the prey species, so that's the Octavian. Okay. Early this year, Patterson was the lead author in a study that concluded that evolutionary arms race happened in just 20 million years rather than 56 million years that had previously been estimated. Some trilobites at emu play shell show evidence of injury caused by shell-crushing predators. UNE PhD student Russell Bickland last year reported that some shell-crushing marine animals had already evolved optimal biochemical performance for their task more than half a billion years ago. The Russell's studies was perhaps even more effective at crushing shell prey than the modern counterpart, the horseshoe crab, which is, you know, the biologically unrelated. They've just gone to the same defense mechanism, but it means that, you know, if you are attacking each other, you get rewarded from it for, you know, a sort of like competition is the reward system for getting better. Like evolution has this Earth. Talent. Earth has talent, and you know, but you get knocked off. I'm just really, really trying to. I can see the chemicals, but I can't think of the material. And it's also interesting how these form sort of interesting metamaterials make it much stronger. Okay, here's an interesting article. It calls hyphens stifle citations. Academic papers with hyphens in their titles credited for fewer citations than those without hyphens, according to a study led by the University of Wollongong researchers. Citation counts can influence the academics' careers and whether they gain promotions or not. They are also one of the measures used to rank universities by most university ranking systems. The study, published in IEEE Transactions on Software Engineering, examined two large citation bases, with 140,000 papers from Scopus and 350 papers from the Web of Science analysed. Scopus covers life science, social science, physical science, health sciences, while the Web of Science includes science, social science, and arts and humanities. The studies found that the presence of hyphens in the title increased the possibility of being copied inaccurately when being cited. For example, a colon might be replaced by a dash or hyphen, or a hyphen might be dropped from between two words. This pointed to the problem with the ability of Scopus and Web of Science to accommodate small errors in cited titles when counting. So I can imagine going to this, you know, in lecture, and this would be just the most bore your head off. Quote, our in-depth, in-depth analysis revealed robustness defects in Scopus and Web Science, resulting in erroneous citation statistics of papers with hyphens in their titles. So the study's lead author, Associate Professor Lin Kuan Zhu, sounds exactly like it. Even a minor typo can cause serious citation indexing failures due to the software system's inability to cope with data errors. Initially, transcription errors are then amplified through second and third hand citations when people copy inaccurate citations from another citing paper's references. What are you doing that? Are you actually citing it? I do. In 2015, found that papers with shorter titles are cited more than those with long ones. However, Zhu's study shows the number of hyphens in the title rather than the title length that is dominating the factor of citation counts. Quote, usually the number of hyphens in title length are correlated, given the misinterpretation of citation counts depends on title lengths, Zhu said. Research team looked at whether hyphens, obviously you want to do a cross-variant title length and hyphens. The research team looked at whether hyphens affected citation counts in different disciplines, e.g. biosciences, chemical sciences, computing sciences. While there was some variation in the effect, it appeared in all disciplines. Oh, that's a bit scary. Researchers further investigated the impact of hyphens and paper titles in software engineering journals and found that journals with higher impact factors publish a lower percentage of papers with hyphenated titles. I think this is all whack. Researchers chose to focus on hyphen because it was an ambiguous character. In a citation database, the citing's article's reference list, it can be represented by a hyphen, a subtraction, a negative sign, an N dash, an M dash, horizontal bar, or a list icon. Okay, that just makes me... Oh, a number of hyphens in the title. So, physics has a sudden big bang for having greater than four hyphens. And chemistry, maths is getting up there, but medicine and biology is pretty low. Okay. Oh dear, how boring can you get? Okay. Ocean winds and wave height rises. Extreme ocean winds have and wave heights are increasing around the globe, with the largest occurring in the Southern Ocean. So the Southern Ocean really affects our weather in Australia. And it means it's bloody cold, but it's interesting that I can imagine even a small height would do it. Professor Ian Young and Dr. Augustinus Ribal of the University of Melbourne analysed the wind speed and wave height measurements taken for 31 different satellites between 85 and 2018, consisting of approximately 4 billion observations, and compared these with more than 80 buoys deployed worldwide, making the largest, most detailed data set of its type ever compiled. They found that extreme winds in the Southern Ocean have increased by 1.5 metres per second. Okay, I must admit, I don't like them writing that. I like them to metres, stop, S to the minus 1. 8% over the last 30 years, while extreme waves have increased by 30 centimetres, 5% over the same period. Quote, although the increases of 5 and 8% do not seem much, if sustained in the future, such changes to our climate will have a major impact, Young said. Well, I don't know. Quote, flooding events are caused by storm surges and associated breaking waves. Yeah, it's true. The increased sea level levels make these events more serious and more frequent. Increases in wave height and changes in other properties such as wave direction will further increase the probability of coastal flooding. Understanding changes in southern oceans are important, as this is the origin for the swell that dominates the wave climate of the Pacific Ocean, South Pacific, South Atlantic and Indian Oceans. Quote, swells from the southern ocean determine the stability of beaches for much of the southern hemisphere, Young said. These changes have impacts that are felt all over the world. Storm waves can increase coastal erosion, putting coastal settlements and infrastructure at risk. International teams are now working to develop the next generation of global climate models to project changes in winds and waves over the next 100 years. That's true. Quite, we need a better understanding of how much to change is due to long-term climate change and how much is due to multi-decadal fluctuations in the cycle, Young said. Research is published in Science, so it's a good magazine, and I do like how we need to do more. Please fund me more. This is a remarkable fish sea in colour in dark water. So what is it? Our rod cells see motion and our cone cells see colour. And I think so that's precision, colour and precision. I think most mammals have two. I might be wrong. Let's read it through. But we've evolved another one, which has tripped us up into colour vision. So we, primates and stuff like that, have triple colour vision. Most things have black and white. Colourblind vision. Okay, fish living up to 150 metres below the surface have developed a surprisingly diverse vision that would help them determine predators from prey in the dimly lit depths. Vertebrates use two types of photoreceptors, rods and cones, in order to see. Quote, cones are used for bright light conditions, while rods are generally used for dim light, explains Dr. Fabio Cortesi of Queensland Brain Institute. Both rods and cones contain light-sensitive proteins called ospins. Yeah, I remember that. That absorb light at specific wavelengths. Quote, colour vision in vertebrates is due to the fact that the cones use around four different ospins. Well, obviously not mammals, birds have that. They're birds of vertebrates and some fish. Now, this variety are sensitive to a broad range of colours. 99% of all vertebrates have just one ospins in their rods, so are colourblind in dim light conditions because they rely on a single rod ospin, which I suppose we are colourblind in dark things. Fish that live at 200 to 150 metres below the surface tend to be no exception. This water at the depth filters out most light. Down there it's very monochromatic, and most fish just perceive blue light. Said deep sea visual ecology specialist Dr. Fanny de Brussolaris of the University of Queensland. We have discovered some peculiar, spectacular exceptions. A study published in Science examined the genomes of 101 species of fish. On Nemo, we found 13 species had more than one rod ospin gene, and one silver spiny finfish, a remarkable 38 of these, has to be one, Cortesi said. Gene sequence analysis and experiments on how those rod osprins functions suggest a silvery spiny fins were able to pick up a wide range of wavelengths of light and therefore possibly saw many colours. Now, the interesting thing is that turtles have a huge colour range because they've got these little oil drops on top of their cones and put colouring in their oil. Okay, there are many colours of bioluminescence light produced and emitted by living organisms down there, then it mainly appears as a flash coming from other fish. Said, if you want to survive down there, you need to pick up, quickly decide if you are seeking a potential predator or a potential prey. I suppose that would make sense. Let's see. Oh, okay. This is a pretty amazing. There were pictures of the various fish. You've got the lanternfish, the tubeye fish, and the top is the deep sea fish with enhanced vision. Oh, these are all got enhanced vision. This is the silver spiny fish. It just looks like a normal fish. It doesn't look like the sort of fish they have in a fish tank because it's got huge eyes. CSIRO warns of malicious content on trusted sites. You betcha. New research from CSIRO's Data 61 has found that about half of the internet's most popular websites are risks of malicious activity because they depend on a chain of other third parties to import external resources, such as ad providers, tracking analytics services, and content distribution networks. I would thoroughly say this. These third parties can load further resources from other domains, creating a dependency chain of more than 30 domains underpinned by any form of implicit trust with the original website. The research found that the larger dependency chain, the greater the threat to malicious activity. Oh, of course. Quote, most all websites today are heavily embedded with tracking components, said Professor Dalla Kaffa. Quote, for every website you visit, you could be unknowingly loading content from potentially malicious parties and leaving a trail of your internet connectivity. The research found that 1.2% of third parties linked to the top 200,000 websites were suspicious. Popular web resources, JavaScript generally used to improve user experience from the web, is the greatest risk of malicious activity as it is designed to be executed undetected. So this is why, this is why I sort of keep a firewall in terms of my software. When I write software, I get to load files up to the web, and then it just takes the files, and there's no JavaScript in it. I try to do it, but it's not a website. Quote, the potential threat should not be underestimated, as suspicious content loaded on browsers can open the way for further exploits, including distributed denial-of-service attacks, which should drop traffic to websites and ransomware campaigns, which cost the world more than $8 billion in 2018. Well, the main thing is that you can load something vicious and put it deep inside the kernel of the BIOS operating system. So what I sort of think is that you have to that getting some really bad computer, really badly infected computer, it's so hard to pull it apart. Worryingly, the original first-party websites have little or no visibility of where the resources originate. It points back to the trustability. It tells me, like, blockchain content of the web, and need to better regulate the web and introduce standardizing security measures and the notion of explicit trust. Resolving the security issue created by dependency chains will require additional research and support from the World Wide Web Consortium and web hypergiants. In the meantime, CAFA suggests installing simple web browsers extensions such as ADD and JavaScript blockers to limit the exposure of malware activity through the web. A study presented for San Francisco. I'd say definitely, I don't know, JavaScript blocker, I suppose you want to ADD blocker. Okay, we're 37 minutes in. I'm reading rather well, thank goodness. That's a very cute picture of a koala up here. Buzz about bee venom collecting. A bee venom can be used for domestic pharmaceuticals and research into dementia, HIV, and arthritis. It is amazing that it does cure arthritis. It can also now be easily and profitably harvested thanks to the University of Queensland student invention that is safer for bees and the previous harvest techniques, which can provide significant additional income for beekeepers. Quote, research has suggested that beekeepers using existing venom collectors located on the inside of the hive can kill up to 60% of the bee in a colony. Wow. James Watt explained. This is due to stress-inducing harm pheromones, which are volatile and stay in the hive well past the time the harvest has been used. His new invention, Mark 1 Bee Venom Collector, MBVC, is a low-impact external to the hive, saving bees' lives and making collection even easier. And if you're an amateur beekeeper, it's also an amazing opportunity to make money, Watts said. Bee venom can sell for $120 per gram. So that's a kilogram is a lot. And this is extremely valuable to cosmetics companies and researchers, and only takes about an hour to get the venom from the hive. There are a lot of variables with no guarantees, but if you have 5 hives in your backyard, you could be looking at an additional income of $2,000 per month. Okay, that's not, I was doing that. So that's something like 15 grams, which is like a teaspoon. teaspoon of venom. The device works by using a small pulse that the majority of bees do not sense, but the hypersensitive bees will notice the pulse and sting the glass collection plate. So why there? And you can see, I think there's wires across there. My problem here is, you can see it, Mark 1, my problem here is why are the bees there in the first place? Watts developed the invention after conducting research with small polypeptide amino acids at the University of Queensland, but soon needed enough bee venom to get through our experiments. After using the venom from our own research purposes in 2018, we sold our first creation, the Mark 0.5, realising that other beekeepers were interested in collecting their own venom. Watson's company, Whale Labs, are now hoping to crowdfund through Indiegogo campaign to bring the latest intention to the rest of the world. Well, that's interesting. Just reading, this is just complete rubbish as far as I can see this in this article. Device promises faster internet. Oh dear. A research team has developed a light beam device that could lead to a faster internet, clearer images of space, and more detailed medical imaging. University of Queensland researcher and optical engineer Dr. Joel Carpenter worked with Nokia Bell Labs, name dropping, to build a device to tackle the challenge of splitting light into shapes made known as nodes. Oh God. Splitting a beam of light in colours is easy because the nature gives you that one for free. Think of rainbows when the light shines through the glass at an angle, Carpenter said. A mode sorter splits the light beam into modes instead of pixels like a camera would. The result is high quality imaging and communication. Light. You've got mode conversion, so you launch in one mode and it goes through a few bends and goes into all the others if you can. Well, unless the modes are separate, I don't know how, understand how. The study co-author Nicholas Fontaine of Nokia Bell Labs said the device could bring a number of benefits. Quote, each of the modes can have its own independent channel of information, so there must be no, it's got to be independent. And with this device, we can pack hundreds of modes into a single optical fiber, Fontaine said. This can greatly increase the amount of information that can travel through the fiber, leading to faster internet speed for more people.
Okay, continue. Oh, sorry, you haven't heard a break whatsoever. Let's go in and take a telephone call. This is a device, multimodal fiber, and some patterns here shows the phase velocity of the modes. It's sort of like looking into an atom. It's really beautiful to see this. However, the claims are just outlandish. Just as an image can be made by adding a bunch of pixels together, we can make an image or beam by adding together a bunch of these modes, he said. Some things are easy to detect if you look at the modes rather than the pixels because it's displaying the image in a different form. For example, modes could make it easier to detect an image of a planet orbiting a faraway star. Diffraction plane, I don't know, in the late 70s, there was the laser-enhanced photographs where they would fire a laser through and put blocking filters in the image plane. Okay, I did that in my PhD. Okay, here's this really cute picture of a koala going out to have a drink. Drinky stations can quench heat stress koalas' thirst. A University of Sydney study found that koalas will regularly use artificial watering stations, particularly during hot and dry conditions. Drinking stations could also support other arboreal forest herbivores. Folivores such as gliders, possums, and in Australia, and sloths, lemurs, and some kinds of monkeys on other continents.
Koala populations along Australia's east coast have been declining due to lost habitat from deforestation and diseases such as chlamydia, attacks from feral animals, fires, collisions with vehicles. That's the big list. Koalas are also particularly vulnerable to the effects of climate change, suffering heat stress, while the eucalyptus they rely on are also affected by temperature and rainfall changes. Koalas can't simply eat more eucalyptus leaves to compensate for the reduced water content of their favourite food because they are limited in their food intake by leaf toxins. Quote, it's predicted that the increase in CO2 emissions will increase the level of phenolics and tannins in eucalyptus trees. Yeah, it's. I think the thing which is bad is the actual eucalyptus oil. It's got that out of plane. It's like it's a real 3D molecule. It's a really interesting molecule to look at. It says Dr. Valentina Meller, this means koalas will need alternative strategies to find water, and that's where we can help with drinking stations. Meller has been conducting fieldwork in Gunner in Western New South Wales, where the heat wave in 2009 killed one quarter of the koala population. We weren't sure if the water stations would be used to mitigate the impact of extreme weather events, Miller said. But our results clearly show koalas will regularly use these stations to supplement their water needs. During the first 12 months of the study, which has been published in PLOS 1, Miller's team recorded 605 visits to 10 pairs of water stations, with koalas drinking during 401 of those visits. Okay, so it's roughly 4 and 6. They found that the total number of visits and the total time drinking doubled during the summer compared to the other seasons. Meller study has influenced the direction of state and national koala research and the water supplementation adopted in the New South Wales Office of Environment and Heritage, including a specific feature in US New South Wales koala research strategy as used by the Northwest Local Land and Services as a central concept to koala management on private properties. The result has also prompted Campbelltown Council in Adelaide to install drinking stations for the koalas. We need to monitor how effective these are, as the stations can also attract feral animals and predators, said Miller said. Fortunately, we haven't seen any deaths from predators near the drinking stations at Gunnerham. To mitigate the risk, her team has now developed drinking stations that are inaccessible to ground-based predators, of course. Our next steps will be to see if disease such as chlamydia influences koalas' drinking behaviour, Miller said, and we'll monitor individual koalas to examine the drinking behaviours over a longer time. I think this is something for research because it could be, you know, you've got mosquitoes, a whole series of things. Kelpies don't have dingo ancestries. Now, I do know, so the Kelpie is the Australian working sheepdog. So as you've got the big woolly dogs in Europe, we've got a sort of a short-haired, dusty, back-of-the-ute dog. A much more robust dog. And I think people do believe that they're part dingo. Researchers at the University of Sydney have found no genetic evidence for the iconic Australian Kelpie shares ancestry with the dingo. There's a long-standing belief that the Kelpie breed contains genes that the Australian dingo. It's been said the dingo was a mix of the Kelpie and originally came from Scotland to produce a more resilient, hardy dog that would withstand dry Australian conditions. Said Professor Claire Wade, our analysis shows there's no genetic evidence for this from any genes affecting the way domestic and wild dogs look. Wade said some people have come to believe their connection simply because the two dogs look similar. They both have pricked ears and a similar body shape and hair texture, and some Kelpies are yellow and cream in colour. Quote, there's a bit of Australiana and sentiment there, Wade said. We wish the Australian Kelpie was somehow special and unique to us, but the breed has come from Scotland, and the way we make it our own was by selecting it for our harsh climate. Wade published in Genes characterised known gene varieties of Kelpies with those of sequence of Australian dingoes. However, none of the coat, colour and ear type genes analysed supported their shared family history. Dingoes are believed to have arrived in Australia more than 4,000 years ago, more likely with Asian seafarers, while Kelpie was brought to Australia in the late 1800s from Scotland. They're a herding dog derived from the Scottish smooth collie, or fine collie. Okay, this pop. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.